Welcome into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. We have a very good topic for you today, and one that has intrigued me to no end since we first heard of it with Jeffrey Epstein, and it kind of goes down the rabbit hole. We're about halfway down the rabbit hole because there's more to come with it. Last week, it may have gotten buried in your news feed somewhere that Ghislaine Maxwell was convicted in the Epstein sex abuse case. It didn't get buried in my rabbit hole. I was very intrigued with this case. As you know, we were coming up on the holidays. People get focused on different things. They get focused on getting their shopping list done. They get focused on having people over for the holidays. And one of the things that they tend to want to forget about are some of these important cases. And this is one of those important cases having to do with trafficking of teenage girls that we really do need to keep in the forefront. And of course, Ghislaine Maxwell, the trial came to a close. And of course, Ghislaine Maxwell was found guilty. Essentially, it was a month-long trial. And it did have some sordid accounts of the sexual exploitation of girls as young as 14 years old. There were four women who described being abused as teens in the 1990s and early 2000s at Jeffrey Epstein's palatial homes in Florida, New York, and New Mexico. Jurors deliberated for five full days before finding Maxwell guilty of five of six counts that she was brought up on. With the maximum prison terms for each ranging from 5 to 40 years in prison, Maxwell faced the likelihood of years behind bars, an outcome long sought by women who spent years fighting in civil courts to hold her accountable for her role in recruiting and grooming Epstein's teenage victims and sometimes joining in the sexual abuse. Some of the stories are downright chilling. We're going to talk to our guests about some of those stories and actually some of the behaviors in the stories that will just downright chill you. As the verdict was read, Maxwell was largely stoic behind a black mask. Afterwards, she could be seen pouring herself water as one of her attorneys patted her back. She stood with her hands folded as the jury filed out and glanced at her siblings that faithfully were in attendance each day of the trial. As she herself was led from the courtroom, she did not hug her lawyers on the way out, which was a marked change from previous days during which Maxwell and her team were often physically affectionate with one another. One of her victims, Annie Farmer, said she was grateful that the jury recognized Maxwell's pattern of predatory behavior. She has caused hurt to many more women than the few of us who had the chance to testify in the courtroom, she said in a prepared statement. I hope that this verdict brought solace to those who need it and demonstrates that no one is above the law. Even those with great power and privilege will be held accountable when they sexually abuse and exploit the young. U.S. Attorney Damian Williams praised the victims who testified against Maxwell, rather, after experiencing what he called one of the worst crimes imaginable. I want to commend the bravery of the girls, now grown women, who stepped out of the shadows and into the courtroom. Their courage and willingness to face their abuser made this case and today's result possible, he said in a statement. No sentencing date has been set for Ghislaine Maxwell. Now I want to bring in our guest for today, Dr. Carol Lieberman. MD, MPH is a forensic psychiatrist, jury expert, expert witness, and columnist of Inside the Criminal Mind in Front Page Detectives, which you can find at frontpagedetectives.com. She was trained at NYU Bellevue, including the forensic unit, where all the notorious criminals are held, and at Anna Freud's London Clinic. You can check her out at her website at expertwitnessforensicpsychiatrist.com, which we have a link to that website in the description of this program. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome to True Crime Tuesday, Dr. Carol Lieberman. Hi, Dr. Lieberman. How are you?
Hi there. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. We're gonna start out slow and talk a little bit about this case in which, you know, for a lot of people might have just been titillating, but really is quite a serious case. And when we talk about child and teenage abduction and sexual abuse, I think titillating because for most people, this was the kind of the upper crust of society that got involved with Jeffrey Epstein. And really, with most people who weren't familiar with Jeffrey Epstein, he kind of came out of nowhere and got involved in the financial world and then worked his way into some of the more well-known people of power from there. And I want to get a mindset from you. And as a forensic psychiatrist, I need to get a quote from you. I'm going to give you a quote, and I need to get your opinion on this quote, because I found this quote kind of chilling from Jeffrey Epstein himself.
Okay.
Jeffrey Epstein was interviewed by the New York Post in 2011 when he was brought up on charges. He gave them the quote of, "I'm not a sexual predator, I'm an offender. It's the difference between a murderer and a person who steals a bagel."
Okay, say that one more time.
Right. He said, "I'm not a sexual predator, I'm an offender. It's the difference between a murderer and a person who steals a bagel."
That's quite a quote. Well, obviously he is diminishing the seriousness of the crime, meaning like he's not a sexual predator. He doesn't, that's not his MO. That's not what he does or who he is. Like he occasionally offends is basically what he's trying to say. He occasionally steps over the line, you know? And I would say that there are differing numbers given as to how many times he stepped over the line or how many victims he has. But I think sexual predator does do him justice.
Does this give you an idea of what not only Jeffrey Epstein, but maybe Ghislaine Maxwell herself think of themselves? Does that kind of set the stage for what it is they thought they were doing? Was it just a dalliance and not criminal?
Yes, I think both of them really did kind of see it in that way, a dalliance. But, you know, first of all, let me just say, of course, I am, you know, totally against anyone being abused, mm-hmm. sexually, physically, emotionally, any kind of abuse is horrendous. And sexual abuse in particular, physical abuse as well, but sexual abuse lasts a lifetime. I mean, the scars of sexual abuse last a lifetime. I have treated countless people who have been sexually abused, and I was an expert witness in numerous cases of sexual abuse. Most of the time, I was retained by the victims or their lawyers, but sometimes I was retained by the alleged abuser. And when I did my psychiatric evaluation of the people who were saying that this person was an abuser, I found that they were lying. They were malingering. I mean, you know, people just assume there's this whole thing of from Me Too and so on. Well, if a woman says that she was abused or harassed or whatever, you should just believe her. Well, I can tell you, I don't know what the percentage is. Most of the time they are telling the truth, absolutely, but it's not 100% of the time. There are sometimes other reasons. And in this case, you know, these women, I probably am not as sympathetic to, I mean, I'm more sympathetic to Ghislaine and not as sympathetic to these particular accusers because, first of all, they have already gotten money from Jeffrey Epstein's fund. You know, after he died, they set up a fund for his victims, and they've gotten a lot of money. And they, you know, this is double dipping. I mean, this is, you know, they want to go after her too. And also they want not just the money, it's the fame. They're 15 minutes. They want to prolong their 15 minutes.
Okay.
So I was really disturbed when I saw, you know, after the verdict came out, and it was, of course, it was on all the different networks. And people were like dancing on her grave. They were so delighted that she had been found guilty of 5 out of the 6 charges. But like with such glee, like, hello, you know, it was very inappropriate because I kind of compare it to the attitude and the reaction that people have to all of the murderers and rapists who are being let out of jail every day because of no bail or low bail, and who go out and recommit crimes, murders and rapes. And like the man in Waukesha who, you know, drove his car through the parade because he was allowed out on $1,000 bail.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it just seems very disproportionate to what she did. Again, not saying that, of course, sexual abuse is horrendous, and where there's smoke, there's fire. But it was Jeffrey Epstein who was the one who was abusing them.
Okay, but I see what you're going with here, but I want to bring up some specific some specific things here and see if you still think that same way, because I do have some examples of how she joined in, so to speak, and whether you still think that way. I mean, there are some examples in here that I have. I mean, not just recruiting these women for Jeffrey and bringing them aboard for Jeffrey to abuse, but there's also well, let me get to it and I'll see if maybe your mind hasn't changed slightly there too. Mm-hmm. I think there's I understand the idea that they receive payment and then they're going after her, but let me throw this in here and we'll see where we go from there. So there's an article out there that cites some of the things that were facilitated by Maxwell. It says here that she has caused hurt to many more women than the few of us who have had a chance to testify in the courtroom. Let me get to the, you kind of caught me off. I'm not going to lie. You're going to kind of caught me off guard with that.
I know. I had a feeling. I mean, I know. Most people are not saying what I'm saying.
No, and that's fine. You're more than entitled to that. There's an example here of, and I'm trying to find it exactly because I want to read you the, here we go. Okay. The government's case, it says here, however, was damning. As Assistant U.S. Attorney Allison Moe noted in her closing arguments. Oh, no, that's... okay, there's an example where Maxwell doesn't just pay off the girls with money and gifts, such as Victoria's Secret underwear, in return for them giving Epstein massages, which was merely a smokescreen for sexual abuse. One victim testifying under the pseudonym Jane told the court that beginning when she was 14, Maxwell not only made her feel more comfortable with the increasing sexualized atmosphere in Epstein's estate in Palm Beach, Florida, but also actively participated in her abuse. She, along with others, would just start taking their clothes off, Jane said. And Jeffrey would get in on the massage table, and it would just, and this is a quote, and it would just, you know, sort of turn into an orgy. So the victims are saying here that Ghislaine Maxwell would not only recruit them, but also get in on the sexual abuse. That it was not just, you know, she would ply them with gifts and, you know, kind of pry them into giving Jeffrey massages that would lead to the sexual abuse, that she would join in on the sex as well.
Well, but they're very vague about exactly what she did, and also that assumes that you believe what they're saying. Now, you know, before Jeffrey Epstein died, these women were expecting to go to court, to go to trial against him, and they, in their depositions and in their reports to the police and other authorities, they talked all about all the horrible things that Jeffrey Epstein did to them.
Mm-hmm.
There was hardly a mention of Ghislaine Maxwell. Then he died, and now all of a sudden, the only, aside from his fund, the only person to go after in court was her. And now all of a sudden, their stories changed, and they started including her in all the what you just read, for example. And making her role a lot bigger.
Right. Well, I read of one woman named Jane. There's another woman named Carolyn. This woman, Carolyn, stated that on one occasion, this having to do with, it says here, on one occasion, Maxwell entered a massage room where Carolyn was standing in the nude. She came in, felt my boobs and my hips and my buttocks, and said that I had a great body for Mr. Epstein and his friends, Carolyn testified. She also said that when she confessed to Maxwell that her own grandfather had begun raping her when she was 4 years old, this revelation didn't seem to deter Maxwell and Epstein from continuing to abuse her. Then they talk about a fourth woman, Annie Farmer, the only victim who testified under her full name, spoke of Maxwell's grooming methods. The socialite bought Farmer, who was 16 at the time, cowboy boots and engaged her in amiable conversation and later gave her a sexualized massage at Epstein's ranch in New Mexico. So there were four women that that had actually testified in Maxwell's trial. And I know what you're saying here. I get what you're saying. But these four women had all talked about how she had gotten involved directly in the massages with and in sexual recourse, I guess. I don't know what I want to say, acts, because I wasn't there and I don't know. But that some sort of sexual activity had happened with Ghislaine Maxwell. With that being said, when I throw that out there, I know you say that's their stories. I don't think their stories have changed. That's the one thing that isn't being pointed out.
No, that's not true. That's not true. Their story did change. That's why, for example, she had, the defense had a forensic psychologist who talked about memory and how memory changes over time and so on. And her lawyers also were pointing out when they were cross-examining these women about the discrepancies in their testimony from before when Jeffrey Epstein was alive to now. But, you know, these things were kind of vague. And I'm not condoning any kind of sexual abuse. But, you know, these, like in those stories that you just, that testimony that you just described, mm-hmm. these women, you know, in the cases that I've been an expert on for the victims of sexual abuse, they were in situations where they couldn't escape, the ones that I worked with, either because they were little kids and it was their parents who did it, or an uncle or something, and they didn't have anybody to tell, or they were afraid or ashamed, you know, all the typical reasons why people don't tell. But they were stuck in a situation. Even, you know, I did the lead cases of priest sexual abuse in Los Angeles. And these men, now men, you know, but when they were boys, their parents were all about the church. That was their, you know, they were in love with the church, and they were, you know, in love with the priest or the pastor, and they trusted him. And so a lot of these boys didn't want to tell their parents what the priest or the pastor was doing because they didn't want to hurt their feelings, you know, or not, it's more than hurt their feelings. They didn't want to bust their bubble.
Okay.
And they were ashamed, and they were, victims of sexual abuse always blame themselves. So they feel they must have done, you know, if their parents think that these priests are so wonderful, then it must have been them. You know, they must have made the priest sin. So for all these different reasons. So these are people who were like in a situation that they couldn't get out of. But the girls that you just described, and who were the four women testifying, they were not locked up in Jeffrey Epstein's house or any of his places, any of the places that they were being abused, even on the island. They knew when they got on the plane where they were going, you know, what was going to happen by that point. So why did they keep going along with it? I mean, really, some of them, have talked about it was the dream. They knew, if you want to say it was Ghislaine who knew how to manipulate them. Her father was a great manipulator. And it is said that she probably learned this from him. So did she, you know, she knew how to pick, kind of like Michael Jackson. They pick people, they know how to choose the victims, mm-hmm. people who are the most, either the girls who were poor, you know, and couldn't afford certain things, or girls who had a dream and they were able to, because of the people they knew, they were able to facilitate the girls' dreams. But nobody was tying them up and making them stay in Jeffrey Epstein's house or making them come back.
Well, Dr. Lieberman, if I can play devil's advocate for a minute here, and take the prosecution side and just look at it like this. Money is the perfect rope, if I could put it that way. You say that nobody's holding them down or tying them down, but think of it this way. A lot of the women, or a lot of the girls, I'll put it in the proper context, a lot of the girls that they came across were either girls that they came across that they were either working somewhere. I think one was even working at Mar-a-Lago, if I remember right. But they were working somewhere and they had dreams or aspired to do something with a better life. So you see a man who's very rich, who has a lot of tokens around him that suggest wealth. And you think to yourself, wow, if I could only be a part of that. Well, you only have one thing that you can contribute to at the time when you're a teenager, and that's yourself. That's it.
Okay, but then you can't blame Ghislaine for that. That was a choice. If I'm not saying, like, if they wanted to make that choice, but that's fine. That's their life, and they can make whatever choice they want. But then you don't come back years later and blame somebody else for your having made that choice.
But now let me finish on this point. And this is where it's a slippery slope. At the age of 14, you are not able to make that type of a choice as to whether you want to give up your body or not. At that time and point, you're making irrational, childlike decisions of whether you want to please a grown man who's way, way older than should be expected to be able to make. And I'm trying to find a good way of putting this. A grown man who wants to basically have sex with you and you're in the 14 to 16 year old range, you should be probably not be thinking about one night stands and rendezvous, kind of dirty rendezvous. You should probably be thinking about things like dates and proms and more innocent things like that. And yet he's luring you in and using the wares that he has around him to get what he wants, yet he's not really offering you anything. He's just displaying it. In that, there is a deviousness to it. And that's the rope he's throwing out there.
He did, yes, but he did actually give the girls a lot. Yes, there are laws for, like, rape of a minor, statutory rape and all of that to protect people who are minors because of the very things that you're saying.
Right. And I would state this. What's the difference between a van and candy and Victoria's Secret underwear and boots and a mansion?
I would say
what's the difference between one sexual predator using a van and candy and another sexual predator using Victoria's Secret underwear and boots and a mansion?
A van and, oh, you mean like the typical sexual predator on the street?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the typical sexual predator on the street, those girls, you know, they fight back. They don't want to go with him for candy.
It's a different level. It's bigger bait. It's bait that you would go, oh, well, of course if it's a van or a van and candy or a van and a puppy, you would go, well, wait a minute. I wouldn't do that for a puppy. But if there's promises of bigger things and bigger things to come and life-changing things, life-altering things, it makes you think twice. And in that, there is a level of manipulation that I think really does mess with the mind of a 14 to 16-year-old. Now, you and I, as grown adults, go, there's no way this guy is going to settle for me, you know, for a quickie in a mansion. We all know what he's going for. Or if he's picking on 14 to 16-year-olds, we all know what he's going for. We know what the game is, and we know what he is. But for a 14 or 16-year-old, I don't think they realize that. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yes, but I mean, I'll grant you that they don't have they're not as experienced, and they don't have as fully developed a sense of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
However, these were not girls who were, I mean, like you said, one of them worked at Mar-a-Lago. Other ones, you know, I was reading about the various women and you know, for the most part, I mean, some of them were poor and so on, but they were not necessarily unsophisticated. I mean, you know, these days, 14 to 16-year-old girls, and even back then, you know, I know it wasn't, it was years ago, but I'm just saying, I'm not saying that there was nothing wrong that happened, by no means. I mean, if it were Jeffrey Epstein himself, I wouldn't be saying these things. You know, I feel more strongly about that he should be paying for what he did, because he was the one. I mean, Ghislaine, let me go back up a little bit.
Sure.
Ghislaine has a very interesting childhood.
Okay.
Yep. And, you know, when I'm an expert witness, especially for the defense, I mean, when I am an expert witness for the defense, what I primarily do, you know, I first of all, I spend a whole day with the parties in lawsuits, you know, getting to doing psychological exams giving them testing and so on. So that I can come to a conclusion. I ask about their life beginning from the time that they were born. And in fact, even going back before, like how did their parents meet and where did their parents come from? And are there any mental illnesses in the family or anybody see a psychiatrist or a psychologist? I go back as far as you can go. And then I bring this person, I ask about all kinds of things in their life, throughout their whole life, and particularly about their childhood. And then I'm able to explain to the jury what brought this person to this point of whatever the issue is,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a criminal issue or a civil issue, I can explain to the jury who they are and how they got this way. And for the defense, that is how the jury can feel compassion for the defendant. So, for example, if I had been the expert witness for Ghislaine, mm-hmm. what I would have talked about was her childhood, her relationship with her father, I mean, my first book was called Bad Boys, Why We Love Them, How to Live with Them, and When to Leave Them. And I described 12 different types of bad boys and what causes a woman to go be attracted to a bad boy, all of them, any of them, is her dysfunctional relationship with her father. Now, Ghislaine had an extremely dysfunctional relationship with her father. When she was born on Christmas, a few days later, her older brother, 15 years old, was in a car accident, and he went into a coma, and he stayed in a coma for 6 years, and then he died. And the family kept him in a medical facility that was very close to their home. And so during all that time, the brother was the focus of the family's attention. And when Ghislaine was 3 or 4 years old, she went up to her mother and she said, I exist. And that got her mother and her father, who overheard this, to realize, yes, she was the youngest of the family, and to realize, yes, we have been ignoring her. So then the father made her his favorite. But even though she was his favorite, she still got the treatment that all of the kids got, 9 kids got, which was that he was a tyrant. He was very demanding. And he would quiz them on things. And if they got the answer wrong or they didn't do something that he wanted them to do in an exact way, they would get punished severely. So Ghislaine had this sort of dichotomy. On the one hand, she was his favorite. On the other hand, he punished her just like he punished the others, and very severely. And so then he died in 1991, and his death, similar to Jeffrey Epstein's, was a mystery. It's still to this day, it isn't clear whether he committed suicide, whether he was killed, or whether it was an accident.
Okay.
He died on the boat, his yacht that he named the Lady Ghislaine. And then she went to New York. He had sent her to New York before that to be his emissary in New York to help him conduct business with various things that he did in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right after that that she met Jeffrey Epstein and started being involved with him. And so she became obsessed with him. He was what became the substitute for her father.
Okay.
And she did everything that he wanted her to do. For fear of, one, his abandoning her, like her father abandoned her when he died, and two, like being severely punished, not necessarily with, being spanked, obviously, but, in some other severe, taking his attention away, whatever the punishments would be.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have gone into all of this kind of twisted relationship she had with him and how she did all of these things out of fear.
Okay. With that, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask a little bit more about Ghislaine and her upbringing and why these things weren't more properly introduced and why we had the outcome in the trial that we had. And I also want to go a little bit further into the relationship of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. You're listening to the best in true crime talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the best in true crime talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest today is Carol Lieberman, Dr. Carol Lieberman, I should say, forensic psychiatrist, jury expert, expert witness, and columnist of Inside the Criminal Mind in Front Page Detectives. That's at frontpagedetectives.com. You can check out her website, which is expertwitnessforensicpsychiatrist.com. Once again, expertwitnessforensicpsychiatrist.com. You also have some books there as well, Doctor, that people should check out. And again, the website is at the description of this show, which is right on in the description of the show, which is available as you're listening to it. Doctor, before the break, we were talking a little bit about Ghislaine Maxwell and her relationship with Jeffrey Epstein and how under the surface it really is connected to the issues with her father, which you brought up an interesting point and how, as an expert witness, you would have connected these two things. The fact that her father eventually did make her her favorite, even though she had to fight for it. She really did have to fight for it. That she eventually curried favor with Jeffrey Epstein. Now, here's the question. Did she have to fight for it by getting him what he wanted? And if that's the case, how come they didn't necessarily bring this up in court, and how did she still end up being convicted of 5 of 6 charges in court? I would think that this would have been a lot easier to get her off the hook if you could show that she was more of a victim than a willing accomplice.
Yes, absolutely. Why indeed? Why indeed? Because I guess because they got hooked into this memory question, to try to prove that these accusers' memory, that their memory was distorted because of what they had heard in the intervening years and so on. They hooked onto that and, didn't think about doing it a different way.
There's certain things that come out during the trial too, that interestingly enough, I think might have been introduced that I think weighed heavily against her as well. You know, that there's things that I don't know if you had heard this or not, but there's the existence of the Black Book. We'll put it that way. The fact that she has these records that I guess have been whispered about could bring down the upper crust of social society, if you will, the men of power that could be brought down with you know, just a decision by Ghislaine. And Ghislaine has really been painted in the media as someone who could bring down a lot of powerful men, should she choose.
Right.
Now, I want to get into a little bit of a social profile on your part as to whether that's something she would do. Her brother has said openly to the media that that's something she would never do.
Right.
I want to get your opinion on this. As someone who, it seems like, doesn't want to disappoint, at least with her father, at least with her longtime partner, Jeffrey Epstein. Is this something she would do to someone like, say, Prince Andrew? Because Prince Andrew does have a potential lawsuit coming up with, I believe it's Virginia Giuffre, and more. I mean, there could be potential charges coming his way as well. And you want to talk about somebody who's fallen from grace with the Queen, it would be Prince Andrew. Is that something where she's going to let it lie and not do a thing about and just simply take her medicine and go away in jail? Or is this something where she could potentially expose others?
Well, two things. One is that her attorneys tried to introduce, towards the end of the trial, they tried to introduce more witnesses. And they asked that these witnesses be allowed to be anonymous or with a pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge, and there were like six of them, I believe, something around that. And the judge would not let that happen. So if these are people who, you know, needed to be anonymous, of course, not that like Bill Clinton walking into the courtroom
would be,
you know,
anonymous,
everybody would know who he was, whether mm-hmm. his name was that they called him Bill Clinton or Joe Schmo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in any case, I mean, one can only assume that they were people that some people would know, or they wouldn't need this to hide behind a pseudonym. But the judge didn't allow that, which I'm sure is going to be part of their appeal. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think that she is hoping for an appeal to go through.
Yeah.
And I think she may hold on to the names until she sees what happens with the appeal. In other words, she may be strong enough to last longer, although the jail conditions are horrendous. It almost seems, you know, like they're being purposely giving her worse conditions than other people. Not the jail conditions are great, but you know, she doesn't have, and it's, she's under suicide watch, and she's, you know, in isolation and so on, which is really horrendous in itself. But you know, she's being given really horrible food, and I mean, beyond the usual jail food, like moldy bread and stuff like that. You know, her brother has been talking about it. And so, you know, so I mean, certainly there is pressure. She would love to get out of there and go to where she would go for prison once she gets sentenced. But, and I'm not sure, you know, whether if she's having an appeal while that's going through, whether they would keep her in this jail or let her go to the prison in Connecticut that's supposed to be nicer. But in any case, let's assume that she can hold on until she sees what's happening with the appeal. If the appeal is not being very successful, then I think she might start to name names, you know, to start trading years for names. years of sentence for names.
Let me ask you this, and this is just strictly your opinion. It doesn't have to be your professional opinion. It doesn't have to be anything but just your opinion. Because I have a theory, and I'll share my theory with you as far as Jeffrey Epstein goes and his death. I don't believe for a minute that Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. I don't.
I don't either.
In fact, there was, and you can't find a replay of it anywhere. But I seem to remember as I was watching the initial footage of the day that Jeffrey Epstein died, I seem to remember watching as they were bringing Jeffrey Epstein's body out of the prison. I seem to remember seeing two identical vans at the same time. And this is just my theory. Take it for what it is. Doctor, you can't tell me anything, or if you don't want to tell me anything, you don't have to. I seem to remember seeing two identical vans. And at the back loading dock of the prison. And I just know it's way too convenient that watches were missed, cameras were down, and supposedly Jeffrey Epstein dies. Okay. Too many powerful people involved in a case. This man goes to jail and ends up dead. That's all I know. Is he dead? Is he missing? Was he broken out of jail? You tell me. I don't know. But I just remember seeing two vans, and whenever you see a movie on crime, two vans in a loading dock where someone supposedly died generally means a body bag full of rocks in one, and the guy who supposedly died in the other gets driven to an airstrip somewhere and flies away to an undisclosed location to live the rest of his life after having plastic surgery. That's what that means, which is the wildest theory you'll ever hear. But I'm not saying that's what happened, but that's what happens in the movies. Dr. Lieberman, with what you see out of everything, you say you don't believe that he killed himself. What do you think happened with Jeffrey Epstein on that fateful day?
I think he was murdered. I think he was murdered by the people who didn't want to be exposed by his telling about them at trial. Now, I'm not saying that your idea is totally impossible. It would be possible for, you know, with all his money and so on to, the only thing is though, that, that there would have been people who would see something being loaded into the other van. I mean, I guess they could have, you know, if it was a movie, they could do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they could have managed it somehow, you know, put him in a box and brought the box out later or something like that, or, you know, or some other kind of covering that didn't look like a body, and put that in the other van later, like not at the same time. Mm-hmm. But I think the easiest explanation is, first of all, I don't think that he committed suicide. And the easiest explanation is that he was murdered.
Could very well have happened. You know, and the list could be as long as your arm of people who could have wanted Jeffrey Epstein murdered. Because you don't know who all was in that black book who could have wanted him murdered. You know, people from different sides of the political aisle can point at each other and say, well, that person wanted him murdered. The fact of the matter is that, it could have been anybody. When you're dealing with the world of finance, one deal goes wrong and, you know, somebody loses a lot of money and all of a sudden you're a target. With that being said, here's my question, Doctor. What's to stop the same thing from happening to Ghislaine Maxwell? I mean, she's got the book. She's in prison.
Yeah. I'm sure she doesn't need the book. I'm sure she remembers everybody.
Well, right.
Not everybody, but the most famous people.
Right.
Yes, I think her life is in danger. You know, she could very well have a quote-unquote suicide like Jeffrey Epstein in jail or in prison. Even if she were let out, for that matter, her life would be in danger as well.
Because it's interesting, where when you look at where she was found, it was in Connecticut, wasn't it?
New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, that's what it was. And she's there with her current husband, and it was just a small cottage, like in the middle of nowhere, correct?
Well, she had, by that point, when she was found, she had been living with her husband, who now, by the way, has dumped her for some yoga chick.
Oh, no. Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Yes, poor Ghislaine. Poor Ghislaine. It doesn't rain, but it pours. But anyhow, so she had been living with him and his children sometimes, you know, when they were with him. He was divorced, or he had to have been divorced. And at some point, she thought that it was too dangerous for her to keep living with him in terms of her being found or in terms of something happening, an attempt on her life. And so she moved alone to this other property and where she was found.
Yeah. So, I mean, now, and here's the thing. I mean, okay, so she's in suicide watch, which to me rings a whole lot of suspicious bells in my head, you know, in suicide watch. Where are the, you know, as far as her lawyers go, where are the guarantees? Where are the guarantees that she makes an appeal?
Well, they've already said right away, they said they were, you know, right after the verdict was announced, they announced that they're appealing. And they have other charges, other things, reasons to appeal. For example, this was so talk about fishy. There's so many fishy things. Right after the judge had said that morning, the last day that they deliberated, the judge had said that morning that she wanted them to continue to deliberate through New Year's, however long it would take.
Mm-hmm.
And because she didn't want them going out into the public because they could have more of a chance of catching COVID. Well, and that day, earlier in the day, they had sent out a request for 6 transcripts of witnesses. And then, lo and behold, suddenly, after that, they came up with the verdict. Now, how is it that they went from, you know, wanting to read all these transcripts and so on, not that they necessarily were going to read the whole thing. There were certain points probably that they wanted to look at, but all of a sudden, you know, at the prospect of being kept deliberating through New Year's, they came to a verdict. So that's certainly going to be a grounds for appeal, that they felt pressured to come to a verdict.
Well, that's certainly interesting as well. The other thing, too, that comes up, and I want to get your opinion on this, Maxwell still has, or Ghislaine still has, she's awaiting a trial on 2 counts of perjury, but perjury over what? Was it over her testimony in something previous to this?
It was, I think it was about a depot when she had said that she, there was some conduct that she said that she didn't do, and these accusers are saying that she did do. I mean, I don't know. I don't see how that's going to go very far because, again, and you know, of course, it all has to do with believing the accusers. But you know, it almost doesn't matter because even if she was convicted of perjury, I mean, compared to the sentence that she could have for these crimes, you know, it's already could be up to 65 years.
So I'm going to ask you an interesting question, and I want to get your opinion here. Now, I did mention previously that there is this civil suit that potentially will be filed by Virginia Giuffre against Prince Andrew. And it's one of those things that the House of Royals in England is trying to sweep under the rug. With this verdict, it seems that she wants to gain a little bit of steam over this and wants to use this verdict to strengthen her case and get this the civil suit going. Should Prince Andrew, and this is, and actually I pulled up an article here having to do with that. It seems like right now the Royals are quite nervous, and this is quite the story over there. Should this become a reality, and should the civil suit start over there? There's a good chance that they get Prince Andrew on the stand, or at least get testimony from him regarding all this. Although he's vehemently denying everything, and he's vehemently denying that he even knows her, vehemently denying that anything ever happened with her. I believe his testimony is that something to the effect of he's never met her, I think is what it is, or...
Well, you know, the thing is, what's damning, I mean, first of all, that woman really, she gets on my nerves more than any of them. She has been trying to get more attention and more money, of course, than any of them. And clearly there is something wrong with her testimony, because neither the prosecution nor the defense called her to be a witness. Now, that should tell you everything, especially the fact that the prosecution didn't call her, because she was available. She made a big thing about how I'm available, call me. And they didn't. So she has given, there is something, they were worried that her testimony, that the defense would be able to poke holes in her testimony. And yet this woman keeps, you know, rising into the news, and she's as bad as Fauci. She keeps being in the news every day with some new thing. And, you know, for Prince Andrew, the unfortunate thing for him is that he is in that photograph. Now, I think at one point he said that it was a doctored photograph. I don't think that necessarily is true. But, I mean, they're not, it's damning, but it's not enough to convict. Just because he's in a picture with her,
right.
And he does have his arm around her, but it's not a very sexual kind of how you would do it with a friend, for that matter. I just wish she would leave him alone. And there was something today about how they're asking him to prove that he does have a condition where he doesn't sweat.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I mean, this whole thing is just getting more ridiculous. Just leave him alone. He's in another country. The queen has enough thirst, enough problems, and they should just leave him alone. You know, you've gotten enough money from Jeffrey Epstein's fund, and just drop it.
Yeah, and I'm looking at the article here now. It says that they're looking forward to the civil suit. Not much as far as news goes there, but essentially my question is this: do you foresee something where in this civil suit that you see the same four women come over? Well, I shouldn't say the same four women, but you see some sort of I don't want to say witnesses, but some of the same testimony or some of the same strategy used in the civil suit that you see used here in the Ghislaine Maxwell case. Because obviously, I mean, she has to be able to, the burden of proof isn't the same in a criminal case as it is a civil case, but she has to be able to prove somehow that they were together and that it was somehow arranged by either Ghislaine or arranged by Jeffrey Epstein. So somehow in there, Ghislaine has to be pulled into that case. How do you see that happening point?
Wait a second. Why are you saying that? I mean, if it was, I mean, yes, she would probably be mentioned. But I mean, the suit against Prince Andrew would be against Prince Andrew, not, I mean, yes, she certainly, they would, I mean, yes, of course, she's in that picture as well. Ghislaine is in that infamous picture. So, yes, she would be mentioned. I mean, they probably, if in a perfect world, she would be called upon as a witness. Perfect world for for Virginia.
Right.
She would want Ghislaine as a witness, but then Ghislaine wouldn't want to say anything that would she would plead the fifth, presumably. You know, part of this also is being pushed by the lawyers for these women. I mean, lawyers have made a fortune on this. And they like being in the news, too. You know, doing interviews in the media and so on. Of course, the likes of Gloria Allred and Lisa Bloom, they love just being, you know, in the center of attention in the media. They have all these women in these various high-profile cases. But I just think that we've seen she's been overexposed. Virginia has been overexposed. She should just stay in Australia, where she's apparently living now, and have a nice life.
Well, with
her millions.
My thought was that with the civil case, that it might potentially touch off some of the things that are in that black book, or some of the names that may potentially be in that black book in the civil case, that it some of those things may be alluded to, some of the names. But as you pointed out, the fifth would probably be pleaded by Ghislaine, and I don't know how much Virginia knows, or if she may try to say, well, so-and-so, you know, if she knows of different women that she associated with, if she may start to name names, you know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh. I wouldn't put anything past her.
Let me ask you this. I want to play a what if scenario with you here in the final moments that we have together. Dr. Lieberman, I would say in a perfect world here, where do you see an appeal going with Ghislaine Maxwell? And how do you think they play it different on appeal, the lawyers for Ghislaine?
I think she would get an appeal. Now, what could happen then would be, you know, then if an appeal was granted, then the prosecutors or the courts would be willing to hear a plea bargain, because they don't really want to go through all of this again unless they got another judge to do it. And I'm sure that would be part of the thing. I would bet that her attorneys are going to ask or cite certain things. I mean, one of them I mentioned, the fact that the judge was pressuring them to make a verdict. You know, they would ask for another judge. But at that point, that's the point where Ghislaine could do a plea bargain and name some names. Or she could go ahead with a new trial.
Do you think if Ghislaine names names that she lives through that process? Do you think somebody reaches out for revenge at that point?
I guess she would have to take her chances on that. Yes, of course. The closer people would think that she is to naming names, the more danger she's in. The thing is, it is so debilitating, especially with the conditions that her brother has and her siblings have described in that jail. It is so debilitating that at some point she could come to the conclusion that, you know, I don't want to live under these conditions anymore. So I'll take my chances of getting murdered.
Well, do you think that there would be a down the line somewhere that the district attorney would just say, you know what, we'll cut you a sweetheart deal. You give us names and we'll not only let you go,
possible.
But we'll give you protective custody.
Let her go altogether or.
Yeah. Let her go altogether.
Lower years.
If there's some meat on the bone there, if there's something that will.
It's possible. I mean, I know there are some people who are very hungry to get those names. So anything, it's possible. You know, she's only 60. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of years of protective custody, you know. But anything is possible, really. I know it would depend upon who's hungry to get those names and how hungry they are.
Especially if she had something that truly led to some sort of underage sex ring, let's put it that way. If she said, I have something that will lead to an underage sex ring, which I don't think she does, but if she did, Do you think that the district attorney would bite on it and let her go?
I don't know that that would be enough. I mean, I think at that point it would be really political. If she had stuff to bring down Clinton, and there's already, you know, we know he's been on the plane. And so, for example, if she could name names, name Clinton and tell about what she knows about him, which is a lot. And depending upon whether the person who would be determine whether that would be good enough or not was Republican or Democrat, you know, how much they hated Clinton. You know, the Clintons have been on the hook for a lot of mysterious murders. I learned about this long ago, really. And you know, there was the murder of, oh, I don't remember his name, but the man in Washington, D.C., who supposedly suicided, and the Clintons were suspected of being involved with that. That wasn't too long ago. And other mysterious deaths. And yet nobody has been able to pin it on them enough to bring them to trial. So I don't know. I think it all depends on who's making these decisions.
Right, and all allegedly, we should point that all out, that just for...
Allegedly.
Yeah,
yes, allegedly.
For law's sake, yeah, allegedly. I
just remember, though, when I first heard about it quite a while ago, I thought, this can't... Oh, no, this person doesn't know what they're talking about. And then over the years, there have been more and more things, and yes, allegedly, but it's kind of building up, corpses are building up.
Well, that's the stories. I mean, there are stories out there that do state that. Whether you believe them or not, I mean, obviously, Dr. Lieberman, you do believe them. They're out there. You can look them up on the internet, and they're definitely out there. Mm-hmm. As far as Ghislaine Maxwell goes, I find it an interesting story. I don't think it's the end of the line, though. I think there's we're only kind of halfway down the rabbit hole as far as things go. I don't know. I wait to hear what the appeal is going to be and where we go from there. And it'll definitely be interesting. I definitely thank you for your time today, Dr. Lieberman. Again, if people want to check out Dr. Lieberman, you have a column, Inside the Criminal Mind. It's on frontpagedetectives.com. Also, your website is expertwitnessforensicpsychiatrist.com. It's in the description of this program that you're listening to right now. We've set up a link there. By all means, check out Dr. Lieberman's website. There's also some books there that you want to check out there as well. Dr. Lieberman has been an expert witness in many different trials as well. And there's some fascinating books there as well, Dr. Lieberman, that you've written recently.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lieberman, for being with us. Folks, if you are a premium subscriber to True Crime Tuesday here on Stitcher, stay right there. It's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. If you are not, there's an easy way to rectify that. You just go to Stitcher.com, click on Premium. Click on the button to subscribe to Premium. And there you can get Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals. You can get the commercial-free version of Darkness Radio, and you get access to hundreds of commercial-free versions of some of the best podcasts you've ever heard in your life, courtesy of Stitcher. You're going to want to get in on this deal, folks. It's under $5 a month to subscribe, and it's going to expand your horizons when it comes to audio podcasts. You're going to hear some great programming, and you're going to be glad you did. We thank you very much for joining us here on True Crime Tuesday. We'll see you next week for another edition of True Crime Tuesday.